love addiction has three symptoms. One is that we assign too much time and value to another person. We put too much focus on the other person. That leads to the second symptom, which is then we neglect ourselves while we're in that relationship. So here we are. All the focus is going on that person. They're on a pedestal. They're the greatest things ever until they're not. Then they fall down on a pedestal. Then they fall down. And then the third symptom is that we expect unconditional positive regard from another person. So it means you are going to love me the way that I didn't get loved or didn't get loved consistently in my childhood, because that's what we should have gotten from our parents. And so if we don't get that and we have our dysfunctional thinking and behavior and relationship trauma, we bring it into adult relationships and look for it there.
Hi there, and welcome to Gay Men's Life Lab, the podcast that's all about personal growth for gay men. My name is Buck Dodson, and I'm a licensed therapist and board-certified life coach who's committed to helping you thrive. Each week, we go all in on what it takes to live a full and healthy life with loving relationships, engaging work, a sense of purpose, and all the joy you deserve. And of course, we do all of this with our unique perspectives and experiences as gay men. So before we get into today's episode, if you want to learn more about me and the topics I discuss on this podcast, please visit buckdodson.com. And with that, thanks for tuning in, and let's get started. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of Gay Men's Life Lab. Buck here. I am really excited. You guys know I always say that, but I am just even more excited today to be with my guest, Jody White. Jody, welcome to Gay Men's Life Lab.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you here. So let me tell you a little, let me tell everyone, you already know who you are, but let me tell everyone a little bit about you. Jody is a psychotherapist. She is based here in Austin, Texas, like I am. She specializes in codependency, love addiction, and relational and attachment trauma, which you're going to learn all about today. And she is a recovering love addict herself and is the host of her podcast, Journals of a Love Addict, which you should definitely check out. And she likes to see that she is spreading the word about love addiction because it's really misunderstood. So that's one of the reasons for sure that I wanted to have you come on and talk about this with your work. You know, Gay Men's Life Lab is all about personal growth and relationship growth, but I would say for the most part, most of my sense from downloads and what listeners get feedback around is they want information on relationships in all aspects, from dating to certainly boundaries and trauma and codependency. And this other piece about love addiction, you know, I don't know that everybody knows about it, but I can guarantee you that a lot of folks listening, once they hear you talk about it, will be able to relate. So I'm just really excited to have you here. So thanks again.
Yeah, I can't wait to talk about this stuff. I always love talking about it. You only have me for an hour, so I really have to be conscious of the time.
I know there's a ton of content, and you know if you go check out Jody's website, and we'll give all this information, you know, in the show notes. But it is jodywhitelpc.com. You will see just how much Jody is doing and how much is offered. So really some beautiful offerings, and you can see why she could talk for days, not just an hour. So let's jump in and talk about this. Like I said, you specialize in working with codependency. And let's just start there, because I find there's a lot of misunderstanding about really what that means. So what is codependency, and how do you work with it as a therapist?
Okay, yes, there's a lot of information out there about codependence right now. You know, the first time I can recall hearing about codependence, I want to say, well, it was the 90s. Because I think Pia Melody wrote Facing Codependence late 90s, somewhere around there. And it was this thing that, of course, it's like, oh, this, I read the book. I was almost 30 at the time and thought, oh, this sounds like me. But from that point now, how much more information there is about codependence out there, which is a good thing, but also a confusing thing because it really depends on, especially we've got social media, we've got more authors that are writing, we've got therapists talking about, you know, Instagram, Facebook, And it's a buzzword. It's a huge hashtag, you know, codependency recovery. And so a person could get really overwhelmed if they are trying to figure out what codependence is. And so what I always like to say is, this is what one of my teachers, Guru Singh, said to me many, many, many years ago, always take what you need and leave the rest, like find what resonates with you. And so when we're talking about this hugely broad topic of codependence, you look and see what's out there, find what really resonates with you. And what resonated with me and what I teach and what I'm trained in is Pia Mellody's model of treatment. And so, like I said, that was probably the first book I ever read about codependence, and that was Facing Codependency. She has an entire treatment model based on her experience working inpatient in Arizona at a facility which is now called the Meadows. And she started her work back in the 70s or 80s. And she just witnessed what was taking place with the patients that would come in for quote unquote alcoholism treatment. And back then, we considered the quote unquote alcoholics to be the quote unquote codependent people. But what she saw from working with these patients and working with the families that would come in and learning more about the patient's family of origin and their history and their development and what took place early in their life, they realized, first of all, that codependence really isn't about the alcohol. It's what happened before the alcohol. And then also, it's not really, you know, I don't like the term alcoholic, but what that's what they used back then. It's not the alcoholic. Look at what's going on with this family. And so she just really kind of opened up this idea of what codependence is. And so, you know, to answer your question, and I know we're going to talk more about this, and this is where I have to be really careful because I could talk on and on and on right now. But
well, it's a huge topic, like you said.
It is. Yeah. And so Pia Mellody's model of, you know, which is five core symptoms of codependence, is what I look at as codependence. And she also calls it developmental immaturity, right?
Developmental immaturity.
Yeah. And it's based on all of this takes place. You know, you weren't born codependent. It's really what took place early in life along your developmental timeline. So from birth to 17, 18, which we know much more now that the brain doesn't finish developing until your 20s, mid-20s. And so, but what happened, you know, from birth till about 18, when you're at home, most likely with your family of origin or primary caregivers, what happened along that timeline that interrupted your development and caused you to under or overvalue yourself, so create an issue with self-esteem? What led you to, you know, have issues with who you are as a person? You know, were you wounded around your vulnerability? Were you wounded around being perfectly imperfect, which we all are, right? And then leading to issues with dependence and moderation.
I'm glad you mentioned Pia Mellody and your work, because you are trained in Pia's work.
Right. Pia has an actual treatment model that, and it's a framework of treatment that I use in my practice. Lots of therapists who have trained with her in Arizona use it. And the amazing thing about this model is that once you learn it, you can apply it to all parts of life, not just relationships. I look at it with my work. I use it there. I look at it with the way that I spend money. I look at, which those are all relationships too, our relationship with work and money.
Well, true. Yeah. So it kind of gives you a chance to look at everything relationally. But yeah, when you were talking about those five core symptoms of overvaluing or undervaluing yourself, or perfectly imperfect, or self-esteem, I mean, all these things, it's like, well, yeah, that shows up or could show up everywhere.
Yeah.
And so interesting. And so codependency, you were talking about that shows up kind of, or this developmental immaturity, or these developmental arrests, I guess, if you will, kind of start in childhood. So are there certain like family systems or certain dynamics that would contribute to that?
Oh,
you mentioned alcoholism, or if you could talk to that.
So Pia, the way she looks at it is, okay, there are dysfunctional families and there are functional families. And in a, let's start with a functional family, the family is there to meet the needs of the child. And there's, that's just one overly simplified explanation of a functional family. In a dysfunctional family, the family looks to the child to meet the needs of the family. So yeah, and I actually recently talked with a friend of mine up in Dallas, Daniel Gowan, on my podcast, and he trained with Pia years ago, so he's been teaching this model for a very long time. He was also talking about a dysfunctional family is about a lack of resources. Mm. And so he said, I'm not just talking about the chicken on the table, meaning there's not enough to go around, because that does lead to dysfunction. But it's also that, is there enough love? Is a family valuing more one child more than another? You know, are children having to fight for a parent's attention, love, affection, nurturing, protection, you know? So it's about a lack of resources. And I really like that definition.
Yeah, so, I do too. Both of those, a lack of resources. And then you said the child is responsible for meeting the family's needs.
Yeah. And that is really like, we've got functional families, dysfunctional families. So in a dysfunctional family, then you look at where is the developmental trauma, and that's broken down further into enmeshment and or neglect that takes place, right? If we look at developmental trauma. And so with enmeshment, it's kind of like the example Pia gives is, you know, it kind of start here. In a functional family, there is an emotional umbilical cord that goes from the parent to the child. The parent gives to the child. In a dysfunctional family, especially with enmeshment, it is the umbilical cord is running the opposite direction. So the child is emotionally feeding the caregivers or the family or the parent, right? So it's almost like the parent is stealing from the child instead of giving to the child. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. Which talk about then you kind of, you referencing your colleague, Daniel Gowan, this lack of resources idea. Could see where if there's this lack of resources, then there's a desperation. And then like we're looking to children who obviously are not equipped to emotionally resource the family or the parent. God, that's a setup.
Right. And so really to more specifically go into those five core symptoms and your second question of how this happens in childhood or what it looks like. So if we look at the five natural attributes of a child, and that is that a child is valuable just for being there, right? They're just for being alive. They're valuable, right? So any wounding around their value, whether they are undervalued or overvalued, is going to lead to an issue with self-esteem, right? So that's core issue number one. Attribute number one goes with core issue number one. The second is that children are vulnerable. They need protection, right? And so if they are wounded around vulnerability, overprotected or underprotected, that's going to lead to an issue, boundaries. So that's core issue number two, right? And then the third natural attribute is that they are imperfect. We were just talking about being perfectly imperfect, right? Any wounding around being expected to be perfect, that's going to lead to a core issue number three of being able to own one's reality, meaning like the reality of who I am.
Which is someone who's not obviously perfect, because no reality isn't perfect. And,
right. And and reality is the, we could do an entire podcast on the issue with reality because it's broken. It's one of those that takes longer to teach because there's more involved with our reality. It's kind of like not just who I am, but who I am in relationship, who I am in the world, who I am, how am I reacting, being in touch with the reality of a situation. Of what's going on instead of the story in our head, right? Because we create stories in childhood too.
Oh gosh, yeah.
The fourth natural attribute is that children are dependent, right? They are dependent upon someone. You were just saying like they're not able to take care of, so they're dependent on someone to take care of them, right?
Right. And so they're supposed to be, this natural attribute.
They're supposed to be. Exactly. This is how a child should be nurtured in these natural attributes, right?
Yes.
And so any wounding around a child's dependency is going to lead to dependency issues later in life, which is core issue number four. And that typically looks like either too dependent, so leaning on someone else to take care of them or other people, not able to self-care, or anti-dependent, meaning I don't need anybody. I'm fine over here all by myself. I'm behind this wall.
Yes, right.
Don't worry
about me. I have no needs.
I have no needs. I'm needless and wantless. That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then the fifth natural attribute is that children are open and spontaneous. You know, you see children just blah, you know, and they need to be nurtured in that, but also have boundaries right? A functional family teaches a child, hey, this is so great that you're so excited. Let's talk about how to handle this in this situation, right? But when a child does not learn those boundaries and is either uncontained or overly contained, that will lead to issues with moderation in adulthood, which is core symptom number 5. Oh, they all go together too. So it's kind of like if you had each symptom in it, those 5 core symptoms in bubbles, you know, 5 bubbles, they all overlap. I mean, it really, one isn't out of whack without all of them being out of whack.
Yeah. So it's so you kind of like all those symptoms are probably going to be present in all of, because the attributes are, you know, if we're talking about a dysfunctional family, you know, then all those attributes seem pretty like commonly, right, like they would show up. So, mm-hmm. So you might just have some to certain degrees, like maybe for you, it's less about
exactly
moderation and more about something else.
Right. And I look at it as, let's say I was sitting here and I had a wall of dials behind me, almost like a spaceship or something, I don't know, something like that. And I had 5 huge dials behind me and each one had a gauge on it. And so, yeah, you want those gauges to be in the middle on each one. But the thing is, we live in these symptoms, we live to one extreme or the other. Mm. So we're either anti-dependent or we're too dependent on someone, or we're very contained or we're not contained at all. Or, you know, so
yeah,
we overvalue going one up on with ourselves, or we're one down. So we want to be in the middle on each one.
So that's that moderation piece. Or kind
moderation.
Of one look at it. Okay. And then just kind of take that moderation piece a little bit further, because this shows up certainly. I haven't talked too much about substance use and mm-hmm. on the podcast, but we have explored some issues around, you know, compulsive sexual behavior and things like that. And it's probably telling because, you know, addiction and, you know, things like that love addiction has showed up in my life, codependency, other forms of addiction have showed up in my life and certainly my practice. So it's probably not a coincidence that we haven't explored it too much on the podcast yet. But this idea of moderation, when I think about it, it's, are we talking about like emotion regulation and then how we respond to that with like addictions or things like that? Or am I getting that confused with something else?
All of it. Yeah. So anywhere that you can look at, okay, where's moderation? So yes, with food, with shopping, with sex, with self-care, with bound. I mean, there's moderation can apply to
work.
Anything. Work.
Gotcha.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Does that answer your question?
It does. Yeah, that's helpful. And I wanted to just clarify that because I think listeners, one, a lot of the folks that I see in my practice struggle with moderation. And I think that that's, I would say that's a symptom in some respects of like the trauma of growing up gay, which can be kind of a very isolating experience, but then it sort of, we see higher rates of substance abuse or higher rates as adults and higher rates of perfectionism and things like that. So
exactly. So let's just, again, we're oversimplifying because we don't have an actual case study. But if we look back at childhood and, you know, one of the things I love, and I got this from Kelly McDaniel's work around mother hunger, which is goes so nicely with Pia Mellody's work.
Mother hunger.
But we talk about mother hunger. Mm-hmm. And so we talk about that if we were neglected in childhood, if there was neglect, let's just call it. And so we learn to what they used to call self-soothe. We would learn to self-soothe ourselves, right? And so now we call it auto-regulating because children can't actually self-soothe. That actually is much higher functioning that can maybe come later in life, but it's auto-regulating. So like, let's call it thumb sucking or, you know, a blankie or chewing on our hair, you know, and then as we grow up, we find other ways to auto-regulate. You know, for me, I became really obsessive about, and this is going to sound, this is a story I tell, but in middle school, you know, when there's a lot of anxiety, I would auto-regulate with being very controlling about my environment and about what I was wearing to the point where everything had to be a certain way or things would fall apart.
Gotcha.
And then quickly after middle school, alcohol and sex came along. And so I auto-regulated with that. And then that developed into my codependent / love addiction.
Gotcha. Okay.
So yes, auto-regulating. So we start auto-regulating with sex. And so my therapist said to me the other day that recovery is all about relationships. And it means we have to, she didn't use the word relearn, but I'm going to use that here. We have to basically learn about relationships. And that's not just relationships with others. It's relationship with ourselves, sex, money, food, because yes. all of that got, can I curse on your show?
Oh my God. Yeah. Fuck
okay. It. Yeah. all of that. You can curse on mine. But, because all of that got fucked up along the way.
Yes.
And so, yes, we definitely will have, you know, we use sex to auto-regulate. We use alcohol to auto-regulate, spending, food. And so it's all about, whoa, okay, I'm not doing, that's not, there's not moderation here. What do I need to do to start behaving moderately?
Yeah. Then this is a perfect segue. We can get into more of sort of the addiction piece and talking about love addiction. I'm certainly really relating to it personally. I was on your podcast recently and talked about some of my own personal experiences with love addiction and codependency, you know, but I've struggled in a number of areas that I feel are all core or tied to certainly developmental trauma in my family and growing up in an alcoholic household, and but also kind of how perfectionism shows up as like my drug of choice, sort of fits in with all these other pieces. But this idea of regulating and auto regulating and then learning how to regulate in relationships, you know, in a way, I see this with myself and with clients, like moderation when you're starting out can feel, well, one, it's so unfamiliar that it's like, am I like, I don't even know what I'm feeling if I'm like moderate, because it's not like I'm so used to feeling either like really bad or really good, or, you know, like high or depressed or super busy with work or totally flatlined and can't get off the couch.
Yes. And those are those extremes that Pia Melody talks about, is that when we're swinging from one side to the other, we're going to exhaust ourselves, burn ourselves out, but it's also kind of all we know. In a way. So being in the middle, moderate feels boring, feels like, I don't even know what I'm feeling. Is this the way we're supposed to be doing it?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Is this the way we're supposed to be doing it? Yeah. I like, well, we can get more into that, but you know, I'm often asking clients about, you know, what are you noticing? You know, what are you feeling? Just, you know, kind of the practice of just trying to identify like a feeling, especially with men, you know, because that can be like, I have no idea what we're feeling, but without it being really strong, I oftentimes get the answer. I'm sure you get this too. Like, I'm not feeling anything, you know, or I don't know what I'm feeling. So we kind of tune in a little bit and try to practice moderate feeling identification. It's like, oh yeah, that's, I guess this is probably frustration. Maybe this is a little melancholy. I don't know. Anyway, well, we can come back to that if we want, but I want to sort of dive into this idea of love addiction, not this idea, but just love addiction in general. So can you share about just kind of what love addiction is, and then we'll go from there.
Yes. So love addiction is often confused with codependence. I think some people think, well, isn't it the same thing? And I probably thought that too when I first heard about it. But the way I define love addiction is love addiction is rooted in codependence. So the codependence comes first. So which if you look at codependence as rooted in developmental trauma, the developmental trauma comes first, right? And so, you know, then the codependence, depending on what our unique history was within our family of origin, can then potentially develop into love addiction. I look at codependence as the garden, and then the love addiction are the weeds. It's the weeds that grow in the garden. And the weeds look like flowers, you know, those weeds that can look really pretty. You're like, look at those beautiful flowers. And you're like, wait a minute.
Right. That's right, those are poisonous. Right.
Yeah. And I have to start all over with
That's hilarious.
So you take care of the love addiction. And so we've got five core symptoms of codependence, but then love addiction has really three symptoms. Which are, one is that we assign too much time and value to another person. So I consider it like we put too much focus on the other person, while then that leads to the symptom two, second symptom, which is then we neglect ourselves while we're in that relationship. So here we are, all the focus is going on that person. They're on a pedestal. They're the greatest things ever until they're not. And, you know, because we have them on the pedestal, then they fall down. On a pedestal, then they fall down. and then the third symptom is that we expect unconditional positive regard from another person. So it means you are going to love me the way that I didn't get loved or didn't get loved consistently in my childhood. Because that's what we should have gotten from our parents.
Right.
And so if we don't get that and we have our dysfunctional thinking and behavior and relationship trauma, we bring it into adult relationships and look for it there.
Wow. Yeah, that's really just imagining a lot of people are relating to this, you know. So.
And so let me also say, you know, because people say, oh, a relationship is about unconditional love. You should love me unconditionally. And so the work that I do isn't really so. Unconditional love and unconditional positive regard are a little bit of two different things. Unconditional positive regard in childhood should be, like we talked about, those five attributes. A child is valuable no matter what. They are lovable no matter what. They're going to make mistakes. They're going to be messy. They're going to be annoying, but they're still valuable and lovable, right? In adulthood, we want to be loved with healthy, mature love, which comes with boundaries. You know, if we act out or do something disrespectful or hurtful, ideally we want a partner who'll say, hey, I love you, but this isn't what you're doing right now. You're crossing my boundaries. This isn't respectful. And we're going to need to talk about this. You know, if you are with someone who's just, I love you unconditionally, you can treat me however you want. You know, that's not really healthy, mature love.
Yes. That's a really good distinction between unconditional love, unconditional positive regard. Yeah. So this idea of it being makes perfect sense that love addiction would grow out of codependency, which comes out of these early traumatic experiences with our, you know, families and primary caregivers, that you would be, because addiction is so, I mean, it's at its root, its intention is good. You know, that's how I always like to think of it. You know, it's like the longing is positive. You know, you're wanting to feel good. You're wanting to feel loved. You're wanting to feel like whole again. You know, it makes sense that you would want that if you didn't get that. But as adults, obviously we can't expect another adult to give us these things.
Right.
It's not realistic. It's not going to happen.
Right. Well, and we can expect it. We're just going to be sorely disappointed and frustrated all the time. Oh.
Yeah, good point. Good point.
I spent a lot of time expecting it.
True. Okay. So yeah, that's we can expect it, you know, until we like kill ourselves, you know, emotionally or, you know, like even realistically. Yeah, I've shared this with you before, and I think I've shared on the podcast that I heard Pia Melody once say codependency will kill you faster than any substance. So this idea of love addiction, or I sometimes think of it as like relationship addiction, you know, in some respects. But yeah, I mean, it'll not just kill your self-esteem, but it'll, you know, could be fatal for sure. Yeah.
Oh, yes. I'm glad you said that, because it's true. You know, I think that people hear love addiction and they think it's this fluffy sort of silly thing, but really love addiction is a terrible term. I say that all the time. I don't like that the term love addict or love addiction because it doesn't do justice to what we're talking about. We're talking about something that can lead to death. You know, it can kill you if it is left untreated, and, or that can lead to, you know, a history of just very dysfunctional relationships, depression, anxiety, substance use. It doesn't lead anywhere good. Eating disorders, yeah. Yeah, and all that can go together too. You know, substance use, disordered eating, love addiction, they can all come in a package, really. And using sex as well. So they all kind of come together.
it's kind of a lethal combo. So if you're, you know, back to the three core symptoms, this idea of like kind of putting all your focus on, I'll just put myself in this. If I'm struggling with love addiction, I'm putting all my focus on my partner. and I'm, you know, making you of my whole life. And simultaneously, mm-hmm. at the same time, I am not focusing on myself. I'm not really conscious of my own needs or my own behaviors or anything like that. And then you said number three is the I'm expecting you. And I'll say just needing you. And mm-hmm. my ex-husband could attest to this, demanding from you at times that you know, give me unconditional positive regard.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yes. Yeah.
So look, where does that, where do you go with that? Like as a therapist or someone who, and this may be a good opportunity because you've obviously on your podcast and, you know, this is a part of your story. You share about your own experience with mm-hmm. love addiction and recovery from it. But where did you start with that? And what was your experience? And
so 6 years ago when I was 46 years old, I finally started recovery work. I say finally because I had spent more than 20 years in therapy with different therapists. Mm-hmm. But I look back and I wasn't doing any trauma work. No one, I don't think, ever talked to me about codependence. I think I can remember talking about what I read in Facing Codependency, but there wasn't a lot of information out there at the time. So it's not that the therapists were bad therapists. It's that they didn't understand developmental trauma. They didn't understand what love addiction is and what even addiction is. Because something you said a minute ago about addiction, we're just trying to feel better. We're trying to, you know, it's, and I love what Gabor Mate says about, it's not why the addiction, it's, you know, why the trauma or what is the trauma mm-hmm. that's underneath it. Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're all coming from, you know, just looking for a way to auto-regulate ourselves into feeling whole, you know, or yes. survival too. If mm-hmm. if we're really going back into childhood, it's all about survival because mm-hmm. we must be regulated in childhood to survive, especially as little tiny babies. Mm-hmm. But so at 46 years old, I have a friend who's a therapist, and I had gone through a breakup, another breakup that was very similar to several breakups I'd had before. And I was already realizing there's a pattern here. They all kind of, it's almost like I was in the same relationship with a different guy every time. Mm-hmm. Different guy, actually, but also kind of the same guy. If that makes sense. Totally. Like I was picking the same kind of person and the same pattern was happening. And so this friend of mine who's a therapist recommended another therapist for me to work with who was trained at the Meadows with Pia Melody. And I went in, and in our first session, within 20 minutes, this therapist heard what was going on. I was in withdrawal because I'd broken up. So you do go into withdrawal. Mm-hmm. And my anxious attachment was so flared up. I was could not regulate. Mm-hmm. And this therapist looked at me and said, here's what's going on. You're a love addict. You're attracted to love avoidant partners. And I bet this is what happens. And she kind of just spelled out everything in this pattern. And I was like, oh my God, yes.
That's me.
Yeah, that's me. Mm-hmm. And she said, yeah, this is love addiction. And she turned around and pulled a copy of Pia Melody's Facing Love Addiction. And she said, take this home and take a look at it. And I read it. I mean, I don't even know if it took 48 hours for me to read that book. And it was just, that's where it all started for me. Was it, I felt like, oh my gosh, there's a reason for this. It's not just me. I'm not crazy. Mm. And it just opened up this entire world of possibilities and hope for me. Mm. And so, yeah, that's how it all started for me.
Wow. I mean, it's always so hard to hear, like to struggle for 20 years before having someone name that, you know. And I'm just mm-hmm. imagining anyone who's listening who, you know, is maybe feeling like that.
I should say, I want to give someone credit. It was a therapist I had when I was about 40. I did go in and she was good. I was in grad school at the time. That's when I was going back to school to be a therapist, and in one of my most dysfunctional relationships. And this therapist had just gone to a Meadows workshop in Dallas and learned about love addiction. And so I'm talking to her and she said, you know what this sounds like? And she turns around and pulls out this binder. She said, this sounds like this thing I just took a workshop on. And she's reading and she goes, love addiction. And I remember, first of all, seeing that binder and then also hearing love addiction. And I literally said, I don't know what that is, but it sounds terrible. And I don't want anything to do with it.
That's hilarious.
And so that's why I say I know when people hear the term love addiction, they're like, ah, no, I'm not going to listen to that.
Yeah, well, right. That's hilarious. And I've never like busted out the binder from the training binder that I was at. But we tend to get excited when we learn new things.
I know. And I have a feeling she was more comfortable doing that because I was in school to be a therapist. And, you know, there was probably a little bit of, I bet I can bring this binder out. I was like, no. Right. I just want to come in and complain about my boyfriend.
Right. Exactly. You can forget about your binder. I'm not interested in any of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I want to figure out how I'm going to get him to give me unconditional positive regard.
Right. Help me figure out what's wrong with him.
Right. Yes. Right. Because, yeah, which is that's the like hard, cold reality, I'm guessing, is kind of and also the beauty, you know, of finally shifting, you know, and being like, oh, it's mm-hmm. not all about him or her.
Yeah.
Oh, it's me, which is both like incredibly sobering to be like, oh, mm-hmm. fuck, like it's me.
Yep.
You know, and then it's also incredibly healing to be like, oh, it's me. Like I have choice in here. I don't have to wait for you to like do something different in order for me to feel like I have value or I have, you know, I don't have to make my relationship with you, the center of my universe anymore.
Right. And that's how that the codependency feeds the love addiction, is that there's so much focus on the partner. I call it our hula hoop, right? We all live in a hula hoop, and everything in our hula hoop we control. That's our stuff. With codependence and love addiction, we are trying to live in someone else's hula hoop, trying to manipulate them to be who we need them to be so that we can feel okay over here in our hula hoop, instead of just focusing on this first and then being in relationship.
Mm.
So there's a lot of manipulation that takes place. It's to get our needs met, really. That's what we're trying to do.
Right. Yeah. To get our needs met. And then, you know, as you were saying that, I was thinking like, we learn that. It's just, I like the hula hoop metaphor and visual because it makes me think of childhood, which I was the most shitty hula hooper. I never learned how to do that. But like because that we learned we're doing that. If you're listening and you're like, oh yeah, I think I see a pattern in my relationship, or I'm doing that now, or whatever it might be. You learned, I say sometimes with clients, like you came by that honestly.
Exactly.
It's not like you just decided that you were going to control other people in order to mm-hmm. get your needs met. Like that's not something, it's not like your fault. Like that's a dynamic that got laid down very early in your life and was unconscious. And, you know, it's a strategy that, like you mentioned survival earlier, it's a survival strategy, or it's a way you've tried to get your needs met, you know, having some compassion around that. If you're feeling like you're seeing mm-hmm. yourself in this.
Lots of self-compassion. That's a huge part of mm-hmm. recovery and the work that I do still for myself in my own recovery, but with clients too. It's that self-compassion is a huge part of it, because there's so much shame, you know, that comes with love addiction and our behavior in our love addiction. And so to be able to look back on, I didn't know any better. Like you said, I came about all this honestly. I really did not know. I didn't have the information. I was trying to survive. My wounded child, my inner wounded child, was just trying to survive. And so the idea of recovery is we get in touch with our functional adult self, right? And we develop that part of ourselves so that we can live in moderation. That's what it, you know, within those symptoms that we discussed.
Through that sort of developing that functional adult self.
Mm-hmm.
And then taking care of that inner wounded child.
Exactly. That's what the functional self comes on board to. I call it our inner woundeds, because we have typically more than one. You know, we might have one that's very small and like five or under. And then we have one that, you know, might be 8, 9, 10 or a rebellious teenager. Even it just depends on each person's, you know, what they bring to the table as far as their history is concerned. But the functional adult self comes on board to reparent those inner woundeds so that they don't have to run the show anymore, so that they get what they need. You know, I'm feeling insecure. I don't feel valuable right now. Functional adult self says, you don't have to prove yourself to be worthy anymore. I'm here to handle all this. Everybody's valuable. This is, you know, so there, and it, that's a lot of, it's a compassionate voice.
Mm, yeah. Just hearing you say that, it feels calming. Like I can imagine an inner wounded. I like that terminology, kind of hearing that. And you yourself hearing yourself say that and to feel the, as someone who, you know, has worked on love addiction and codependency and, you know, all that myself, you know, I know firsthand how healing it is to be able to say like, oh, actually I can do this for myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I can regulate myself. I can self-soothe, and not that I always do it all the time, but
we don't always do anything. That's also functional adulting, by the way. There's no perfect. It's like, we don't always do it. I'm going to regress. I'm going to act out sometimes. The thing is, I don't go as deep into my regression. I catch myself. I'm like, oh, I can feel it. I feel it coming. Mm. I can make a different choice right now. I can go, you know, journal about this instead of saying what I'm going to regret later, you know?
That's a great point. Yeah. So the there's room in the functional adult self to choose, maybe even consciously, like, oh, I'm choosing like not a great coping skill, but I'm not going to choose to like really damage myself. I'm going to, you know, maybe we had a therapist come on to talk about self-medication versus self-soothing. And, you know, he was talking about, yeah, sometimes I can, unconscious, I can choose, I'm going to eat this pizza, but I know what I'm doing versus like,
right.
You know, I'm just being totally like reactive and I'm going to eat 12 pizzas.
Right. I'm aware of what I'm feeling. I'm aware of what I'm doing. I'm choosing to do this. Mm. And even in that, you know, being present with it versus, I call it the fuck it's, which is really one of my wounded children saying, fuck it. I'm just going to eat all this chocolate and I don't care what anybody, whatever, you know, it's like, no, I'm choosing to eat this chocolate. You get present with it and it kind of loses its charge.
Mm. Oh, I like that. You get present with it. Is that a part of how you work with clients in recovery?
Yes. Yes. So I can tie this into what you asked earlier, how I got started. And I told you about when I was 46 in that office with that therapist. The first step, though, was working on the core symptoms of codependence. You know, really the first step was, I was in withdrawal. So I was really easy to work with because when a client comes in and they're in withdrawal, we are ready to make a change. When someone comes in and they're active in their love addiction, even if they're in and out of withdrawal, you know, one week they might want to work on it. The next week they're like, no, things are good now with my partner. So I don't really need to look at this stuff, you know. Mm. But when you're really in withdrawal, you are ready to make some change. Especially where I was tired of it. And so the first thing that I work on with clients is we got to look at the codependence. Mm. And so you work on those five core symptoms. Part of that, building onto that, is developing a self-compassion practice, which self-compassion goes with mindfulness. And then that also leads to a better chance of being regulated and in the moment, which helps you own your reality and helps you see what's actually going on versus the story in your head that could be an old, outdated story. So it all goes together. This is all rooted in trauma, right? And so I think that also goes with a lot of times when people come in and we talk about love addiction, codependence, and I talk about this as developmental trauma. People even often can have a hard time hearing that because they'll say, well, nothing bad happened to me as a kid. Well, you know, or I love my family, nothing, you know, but we look at the timeline and no, this is all, there's some enmeshment, there's some neglect, there's some wounding around your values. And so it doesn't have to be this overt abuse that took place. You know, a lot of this is covert, meaning you can go your whole life and not really realize that this affected how you operate as an adult. And so we are in our thinking brain so much of the time, especially if we're just doing talk therapy. I shouldn't say just, talk therapy is very valuable. But the experiential work gets you out of your thinking brain and into, you know, where we can really work with the trauma. Because the thinking brain, the cognitive, we're always up there. We need to get into a deeper place so that we can release some of that stuff that we're walking, the emotional debris that we're walking around with and don't even know.
Yeah, that's a really great point that you're making. And I find this a lot when either I'm working with a couple or somebody, you know, comes in and is struggling with some sort of codependent pattern, or whether it's an unidentified love addiction or love avoidant pattern, if there hasn't been a lot of individual therapy work or work on childhood, there can just right out, like a default is like, oh, my childhood was great. You know, there was, you know, nothing wrong. But that's rarely the case if you are struggling with certain patterns, certainly around codependency and love addiction for sure. You know, you can pretty much bet there was something going on. It doesn't mean your family, like you said, was like overtly abusive and it was awful. It doesn't have to mean that. It's not so black and white, but.
Right. And that's what, you know, it's not about blame either. You know, when we do this work, it's not about, because I think there's fear of that too. If I go back and look at my childhood timeline, what am I blaming my parents? I love my parents. But the thing is, you can love your family and even the best parents make mistakes. And so, you know, you can have compassion for them because a lot of times too, well, my dad had this kind of trauma. My mom had this happen to her as a kid. So I totally understand where she was coming from. Well, that's great. But there, still, here you are, you know, at whatever age you are coming in and you see this pattern of dysfunctional behavior in your own life, we need to look at some stuff. And so that doesn't mean you're blaming anyone. It just means you're loving yourself enough to take a look at this.
That's I love that. I love that distinction. Doesn't mean you're blaming anyone. You're loving yourself enough to take a look at this.
Yeah. I also look at it. I'll say it's not about blame. It's about shifting the responsibility because so often in codependence and love addiction, we blame ourselves. You know, I'm crazy. I'm messed up. This is just how I am. I'm dysfunctional. Okay, well, you weren't born that way. So let's shift some responsibility around. Let's just at least spread it out a little.
Oh, I love that. Yeah. Yeah. At least like you can't carry all this stuff. You know, it's like everybody in the family has a responsibility in this. So yeah, shifting that around and at least like divvying it up a little bit more is it's freeing, you know, for
like
you and for everybody. Right, exactly. Everybody has
a... Share the pie.
Right. Yeah, let everybody participate in the dysfunction. So, Jody, this was really, really great. And thank you for coming on and sharing about these topics, your work with this.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
Yeah, my pleasure. And I feel like there's more that, you know, we could talk about. And I'm excited to share your story and your work with codependency and love addiction and trauma and all of these things with listeners, because this stuff is just so, so core, so important. So thank you for doing this work. And again, everyone, you can go to jodywhitelpc.com and learn all about Jody. And you can check out her podcast, Journals of a Love Addict. And we'll put all that in the show notes. But Jody, this has been great. And thanks again.
Thank you, Buck. So great talking to you.
Same here. We'll talk soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to Gay Men's Life Lab. If you liked what you heard, I'd love for you to head over to iTunes and subscribe. While you're there, please consider giving the show a quick rating and maybe share an episode with your friends, loved ones, and colleagues. And if you want more information, visit buckdotson.com, find me on Instagram and Facebook at @buckdotsoncoaching, and on my YouTube channel, Buck Dotson Coaching and Counseling. And remember that personal growth and creating the life, relationships, and work you want as a gay man is a process. So take one step at a time, rest when you need it, show yourself compassion, and ask for help along the way. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.